Hello and welcome to the Negotiating Ideas podcast. This is your host, Omar Sadr. In this episode, I talked to William Malley, who served as Professor of Diplomacy at the Australian National University from 2003 to 2021 and was Foundation Director of the Asia-Pacific College of Diplomacy. Bill has a wealth of knowledge on Afghanistan, amongst many other publications. In February 2022, he published an article titled Diplomacy of Disaster, Afghanistan Peace Process and the Taliban Occupation of Kabul. Later in April 2022, he wrote an op-ed, Why Now? Afghanistan and Ukraine Nexus. We spoke about both articles. We began by talking about the totalitarian nature of Taliban and moved on to speak about 2018 and 2022 peace talks between the US, the Taliban, and the Republic of Afghanistan. It was a pleasure to record this episode with him, and I hope you will enjoy listening to him. Bill, thank you so much for accepting the invitation and speaking on this podcast. Let me start by asking you the question, how do we make sense of Taliban? How do we understand Taliban? I read from you somewhere that you said we have a misunderstanding about Taliban, and part of it has to do with the discrediting of the rigid Friedrich and Brzezinski's model of totalitarianism, with the disintegration of the Soviet Union. This distracted attention from a key point made by the great Sovietologist, T.H. Rugby, quote-unquote, who said, as a more general term signifying patterns of thought and action that tends to total social control, totalitarianism still deserves a place in the lexicon of social sciences. I wanted to ask you, do you still think so? Do we need to understand Taliban through lens of theories about totalitarianism, and how is that?
Yes, I first started thinking about the Taliban in this sense in the late 1990s, when I wrote a short piece for Afghanistan Info called The Taliban, Fundamentalist, Traditionalist or Totalitarian. And this was animated partly by a sense that the notion of fundamentalism and the notion of traditionalism didn't help very much in trying to characterize the Taliban movement. And I built that into the introduction to a book that I edited in 1998 called Fundamentalism Reborn, right? Afghanistan and the Taliban. The idea of totalitarianism was not one that would immediately have captured the attention of political scientists at the time, because, as you mentioned, the notion as formulated by Karl Friedrich and Zbigniew Brzezinski in the 1950s, didn't really seem to fit the Taliban at all well. If one goes back to the Friedrich Brzezinski interpretation of totalitarianism, they put forward a six-point model, right, or syndrome, which turned around ideology, the existence of a single political party, a centralized command economy, party control of communications, party control of the military, and the existence of a secret police. And one of the criticisms of the totalitarian model was that it was really just an extension of elements of the Stalinist political system dressed up as a broader theory. And I was never a great sympathizer with that particular approach, since it seemed a very static approach, which even in the 1950s had not been very effective in coming to terms with the changes that were beginning to take place in the Soviet Union after the death of Stalin and the advent of Nikita Khrushchev as the first secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. There is another sense of totalitarianism, however, which is really quite different. It goes back to the original use of the term in fascist Italy, then was picked up to a degree by Hannah Arendt in her book called The Origins of Totalitarianism. And that kind of usage is concerned more with the disposition of a particular group to aspire to total control, in the sense that such a group denies the legitimacy of a private sphere of life into which the group has no particular right to intrude. And this seems to be much more useful in characterizing the Taliban than any kind of.
And even if we go by the definition that Mussolini himself gave about what is a totalitarian state, he said that everything is in the state. nothing is out of the state. So, yes, so the Taliban also somehow erased, tried to erase what is out of state, or you may say private sphere, but also civil society and all that.
Absolutely. And I think one of the reasons that in the late 1990s there wasn't that much discussion of totalitarianism was that it was associated in people's minds with the idea of a strong state of the sort that one found in the Soviet Union under Stalin or in Nazi Germany. Clearly, in Afghanistan, there was a very different kind of issue surrounding the state in the 1990s, namely that it had substantially collapsed in terms of possessing any kind of capability to mobilize and redistribute resources on a large scale or in a systematic fashion. But that did not mean that there were not totalitarian aspirations in the hearts and minds of political actors within Afghanistan. And one saw manifestations of that, albeit without the same kind of state power that existed in those earlier systems, in the behavior of the Vice and Virtue Ministry, for example, under the Taliban, which again was driven by the sense that there was no particular sphere of social activity which they weren't entitled to control if they felt that individual behaviors were an affront to their particular idea of what religion requires.
So now if we understand them in terms of totalitarianism, so at least let's talk about two dimensions of it. One is at least they should have an ideology, irrespective of whether we accept the definition of Brzezinski and Friedrich or not. But ideology remains central to any totalitarian entity. And as you mentioned, the Ministry of Vice and Virtue, they are an instrument to implement sort of, enforce sort of ideology. So what do you, how do you characterize Taliban's ideology? Because earlier in this conversation, you tried to disassociate yourself from the notion of fundamentalism and traditionalism, which were two strong concepts in order to analyze Islamists in Middle East. So now, fundamentalists were different from traditionalists because traditionalists are usually these mullahs, madrasas, which existed in all villages, but they didn't have political aspiration. But on the other hand, political Islam emerged after 1970s and 80s as a result of jihad in Afghanistan, and that brought a political aspiration to the religious sentiment of the people. So how do you differentiate Taliban from these two concepts then?
Yeah, where traditionalism is concerned, I think one of the key features to note there is that the Taliban, to a significant degree, were not simply a creature of traditional society at all. They were, if anything, a manifestation of the consequences of the disruption and breakdown of traditional society as a result of the predations of conflict during the 1980s in particular. And added to that, the displacement of millions of people as refugees to Pakistan, where the kind of life that existed in refugee tented villages was very different from the kind of life that villages themselves would have offered in terms of, for example, occupational structures into which people would have moved. And it's almost a commonplace proposition that the exigencies of daily life can knock the rough edges off ideology. But when one doesn't have, as a, in a sense, a normal daily life, but instead is living a daily life that's a product of massive social disruption, then the exigencies of ordinary daily life are not necessarily going to play that role so effectively. And particularly one saw that with people being drawn into Pakistani madrasas, which were at that time under the influence of other radicalizing influences of a sort that fueled a great deal of sectarian conflict in Pakistan in the 1990s, which differed rather from the kind of socialization experiences that the village mullah might have been undergone in Afghanistan in earlier times. In terms of fundamentalism, I think the key distinction there is that fundamentalist movements historically have been modernist. And if one looks at the Muslim Brotherhood or some of the manifestations of Islamism in Afghanistan, influenced by Niazi and people like that in the 1970s, there was a distinctly modernist dimension to those ideological positions that was really absent from the Taliban, who, if anything, were anti-modernist in a significant degree. And to some extent, what that reflected once again was the pathogenic character of the Taliban's emergence rather than there having been a product of earlier developments. They weren't simply an evolution of groups like the Hezbi Islami or the Jamiat Islami or groups of that kind. They were a very, very different kind of group. And in a sense, they probably fell more into the category of what the French scholar Olivier Roy called neo-fundamentalists in his book, The Failure of Political Islam, where he argued that groups would either modernize or they would become marked by gigantic levels of hypocrisy.
Right. So now if we really accept the fact that they are a totalitarian movement, that somehow limits all options for a possible peaceful coexistence with the Taliban, because they do not accommodate any idea which is not aligned with the Taliban ideology, right? So if that is the case, what would be the way out in respect to our engagement or any kind of relationship with the Taliban?
Well, I don't think there's any fruit to be gained from believing that that there'll be significant change in the Taliban movement as a result of engagement with international actors, or frankly, even with other actors within Afghanistan, that one is dealing with a most peculiar force. Where, as is the case with some historically fundamentalist movements, the will of the particular leader in charge tends to provide an authoritative interpretation of faith, which those who are exposed to it then reformulate in their own minds as the will of God. And when that happens, it becomes extraordinarily difficult to engage in a rational argument, because lines of argument that contradict the fundamental precepts that underpin the claims of the leader are simply delegitimated by the assertion that they are irreligious, that they're a product of disbelief, that they are anti-God. And that becomes a very, very difficult situation to manage. The Taliban, in that sense, are not just different from historical political forces in Afghanistan, they're also very different from the historical schools of Islamic law, which have witnessed very significant discourse. And to a significant degree, the work of people like Halak have suggested that when one talks about Sharia, one isn't really talking about a code so much as a mode of discourse which allows interpretation to follow. And of course, you could go back to earlier schools of thought, sort of before the gate of Ijtihad was closed, as it were, associated also with groups like the Mu'tazilites, which offer a radically different approach. But it's pretty clear that the Taliban would simply see that as heretical and wouldn't engage with that kind of methodology of judicial interpretation at all. So one is up against a brick wall under those circumstances. And in a way, it's a mirror of the belief that Western players entertained before the agreement that was signed in Doha on the 29th of February 2020, that they were dealing with people who were, as it were, interested in negotiating their way through concession and bargaining towards a win-win outcome. It's become painfully clear that this was a menacingly dangerous misperception on the part of the wider world. And
yeah, so you clearly think that there was a deliberate or at least benign kind of effort to downplay the Taliban's decisions or behaviors are driven by certain ideology and values. Rather, the effort was to highlight that there is a conflict of interest, and that's why that could be negotiated.
Yes, well, I think one of the serious mistakes that the United States made was to think of the conflict between the Taliban and the Republican system as simply a conflict of interest. which would be amenable to some kind of distributive solution, which is widely discussed in literature on bargaining and negotiation. What this missed was that there was also a gulf of values. That's not to say that there weren't conflicts of interest. Of course, there were conflicts of interest in Afghanistan, all sorts of conflicts. But there were also radical conflicts of values. And virtually all the literature on negotiation will tell you that when you have really radical conflicts of values, it is extremely difficult not only to work one's way towards a meaningful bargain.
But that does not dismiss the possibility of negotiations. Still, you can negotiate with someone who has fundamental value differences with you.
It becomes extraordinarily difficult to ensure that any agreement that might be struck is ultimately honored. And this, I think, was part of the difficulty, again, that arose from the negotiation process, that for an agreement to be honored, there needs to be a genuine good faith commitment on the part of the parties to an outcome which may not be their optimal choice.
In that case, and
that's not always the way in which things play out at the implementation phase. There's a great deal of literature. There's a terrific book by Professor Barbara Walter of the University of California at San Diego called Committing to Peace, The Successful Settlement of Civil Wars, which makes the point that it's often implementation rather than the striking of an agreement on paper that proves to be the really difficult phase of any kind of peace-building process.
Barbara Walter doesn't particularly talk about negotiating with a fundamentalist, but he talks about context of civil wars. And as you rightly mentioned, for him, what is important is guarantees in a peace process, because they are the one who ensures a secured and trusted implementation of the talks. Now, probably one of the flaws of the process, 2020 negotiations with the Taliban, was lack of guarantees. And I think, ironically, I do not come up with any kind of report that President Ghani or even the Taliban demanded for a guarantees when they started negotiation. Do you see so?
Well, I don't think so. And it was partly because it was pretty obvious that with the United States planning to get out using the agreement as an exit agreement, no one else was going to put their hand up to step in to provide security guarantees. And the critical thing that Barbara Walter addresses in her book is the need for a neutral guarantor. A guarantor in a contested situation can't be a player that is aligned with one of the parties. That will never work. We've seen the problem in the Middle East, in the Arab-Israeli dispute, where the United States is seen to be too close to Israel to play a credible neutral role under the circumstances. And in the Afghanistan case, none of the neighbours could be trusted to play that particular role, and nobody in a more remote part of the world was going to play it if the United States, with its military and logistical capability, was pulling out. It was certainly not something that the United Nations would be able to orchestrate, because the UN is no more than a creature of its own member states. And one of the problems in the Rwandan case, which was studied in detail by Barbara Walter in her book, was that the number of troops that were contributed by member states of the UN for the United Nations force in Rwanda was well below the minimum threshold estimated by General Dallaire, the force commander, as necessary for the force to function feasibly. And I think that certainly would have been the case in Afghanistan as well. So this, I think, was a fundamental problem associated with the peace process. It was hugely dependent, fundamentally, centrally dependent upon the notion that the Taliban were engaging in good faith bargaining for power sharing in Afghanistan.
So if
and there was simply no evidence, credible evidence, to give any justification to that belief.
Yeah. So if we are, for example, let's say redesign the process and go back to 2020 and 2018, what components of the process you would replace or redesign in order to ensure that Taliban remain committed, or at least to have them committed in the process?
I would have gone back much further than that. I think without attention to the issue of the sanctuaries in Pakistan, which enabled the Taliban to sustain their military activities, it would have been very difficult to address this problem in any meaningful fashion. The original sin in the American approach to Afghanistan diplomatically was to detach the issue of diplomacy from the issue of sanctuaries in Pakistan. There were plenty of diplomatic tools that could have been deployed to try to address that issue, and Lisa Curtis and Hussein Haqqani published a fairly detailed, carefully structured paper which outlined a kind of ladder of escalation of pressures that could be brought to bear to deal with the problem of Pakistani perfidy. Instead, the approach that was taken by successive US administrations was to persuade themselves that that squeezing Pakistan until the pips squeaked was either too difficult or too dangerous, and that therefore one should frame the Pakistanis as part of the solution rather than part of the problem. This was wishful thinking of the dreamiest variety.
Yeah, so
and it really poisoned the so-called peace process from that point onwards, because it meant that the Taliban always went into the process with a strong military option at their disposal, that the Afghan government was never in a position on its own to address the problem of sanctuaries in Pakistan. It couldn't invade Pakistan. It didn't have the diplomatic clout on its own to address the problem. It really needed its allies to take up that issue, and they failed to do so in a way that was frustrating for the Afghan government, but frankly was also frustrating for the US military and other Western militaries that were involved in Afghanistan, that were well aware of how central these sanctuaries were to the ongoing campaign that their own personnel were confronting on the ground, but which Western diplomats failed critically to address in any feasible fashion.
And this could have been addressed only probably, I assume, through designing a multi-track negotiation where on one hand there was a channel to negotiate with the Taliban, but at the same time regionally another parallel track, but integrated in a comprehensive peace process, would have been talks with the Pakistan. So these two should have come together, don't you think?
Yes, I think talks on their own with Pakistan would have gotten nowhere, because the Pakistani approach, unfortunately, was one that followed an approach that General Zia-ul-Haq actually signaled very clearly to President Reagan in a conversation at the time of the Geneva Accords of April 1988. We know from the memoirs of U.S. Secretary of State George Shultz that Reagan asked Zia how he was going to cope with the fact that he'd continued to support the Afghan Mujahideen, even though he'd committed in the Accords not to do so. And Zia replied, "We'll just lie about it. We've been lying for years about what we're doing in Afghanistan." And essentially that was what happened after 2001 as well, that the Pakistanis lied systematically about their involvement with the Taliban, and Western countries, instead of calling them out, just basically said, "Oh well, yep, yeah, okay," and that sent a lamentable signal. It actually sent from the pretty early days of the intervention, certainly from the time of the invasion of Iraq in 2003. A signal that Pakistan really had nothing to fear from the United States and its allies. After a period in 2001 and 2002 when they had been on a very short leash as a result of the warnings that they had received from the Bush administration. But unfortunately, President Bush then framed President Musharraf as a buddy and was then distracted by the quagmire in Iraq into which the Americans became bogged, and that opened the door really for meddling to resume in Afghanistan. And my personal view is that as long as that option was available to the Taliban to have sanctuaries and the support of Pakistan, they were never going negotiate.
You're right, but at the same time, what I wanted to say, as you rightly mentioned in your article, is that never Afghanistan, even in Genoa Accord of 1988 on Afghanistan, Pakistan and Afghanistan didn't negotiate with each other. And this time also, they didn't negotiate with each other. At some moments, there were mediations. For example, in September 2019, General Nick Carter of Britain tried to mediate between Ashraf Ghani and General Qamar Bajwa, Chief of Army of Pakistan. But since the problem was, since these talks were not officially attached with the mainstream peace process, so that's why it remained ad hoc to a certain level. So my point was, if we could have designed instead of single track talks, wherein only Taliban spoke with the US and later on Taliban spoke with the public, how about a multi-track process wherein it was endorsed by the US also, wherein government of Afghanistan and Pakistan negotiated and solved all those deep strategic historical disputes?
Well, it depends what you mean by multi-track. If you had had simultaneously an attempt to deal with the Taliban and an attempt to deal with Pakistan, then I think one wouldn't have got terribly far. I think what might have been a different story would have been if first there had been a serious confrontation with Pakistan over its support for the Taliban. If that issue had been credibly addressed, then the calculations that surrounded the subsequent engagement with the Taliban would have been a very different kind of story. And in a way, you can argue, and I wrote this some years ago, that if the issue of sanctuaries wasn't addressed, there'd be no point in dealing with the Taliban. If the sanctuaries issue was successfully addressed, there might have been little need to deal with the Taliban because the closure of sanctuaries would have fundamentally changed the nature of the force with which the Afghan government was confronted at the time. But the confluence of the two, a situation in which they were confronting a military force that had bases outside the boundaries of Afghanistan, were therefore effectively invulnerable to attack. And pressure from the United States to negotiate, which effectively make further concessions to the Taliban, was a recipe for disaster.
Yeah. So probably Pakistanis and also Taliban perceive the entire world, Afghanistan plus its allies, like the way that Germans and Hitler perceived in Munich conference and say that I've seen my opponents and they're like worms. Basically, they don't have the capacity. You compare the Doha Agreement with Munich Agreement. Can you talk about that also?
Yes, the Munich Agreement was the agreement signed in September 1938 by Hitler for Germany, Mussolini for Italy, Daladier for France, and Chamberlain for the United Kingdom, which in effect sacrificed Czechoslovakia, which had a treaty relationship with France, although not with the United Kingdom, to the demands that Hitler was making for the transfer to Germany of the so-called Sudetenland region in which ethnic Germans were located. The Munich Agreement, like the Doha Agreement, was negotiated in the absence of representatives of the country whose fate was being determined. There were no Czechoslovak representatives taking part in the Munich negotiations, just as the negotiations in Doha excluded the Afghan government. And the effect of the agreements in each case was to signal, in a sense, the abandonment of a small state by its hitherto allied powers. And that set the scene in the case of the Munich Agreement for the occupation of the remainder of Czechoslovakia on the 15th of March 1939, just half a year after the Munich Agreement was signed. So far from providing a stable foundation for a shrunken Czechoslovakia, the Munich Agreement actually opened the door for Nazi Germany to take it over and establish what was called a puppet state of Slovakia and the so-called Protectorate of Bohemia and Moravia. And not that different from the circumstances under which Afghanistan fell to the Taliban. The main distinction between the two being that Hitler got his will in March 1939 by simply intimidating the Czechoslovak leadership at that time into a capitulation, whereas in the Afghan case, the effect of the manifest abandonment of Afghanistan by its key ally was to trigger a cascade in the social science sense of the term, where even people who didn't like the Taliban at all recalculated what it would be in their best interest to do under the circumstances. And there's not a shred of evidence to suggest that the United States at any stage in the Doha process took into account the likely psychological effects within Afghanistan of the agreement that it was about to sign. And yet we know from a lot of experience in Afghanistan that when regimes change, it's not because a power grinds its way to the centre of Kabul. It's typically because people reposition themselves because it's not a good idea to be on the losing side. And it's perfectly rational for people, if they conclude that that they're on a losing side, to reposition themselves. And this is why paying attention to the psychological consequences of diplomatic negotiations is fundamentally important, but it's a hugely neglected area.
Yeah, this is what you quote Thomas Hobbes, that perception of power is power, and the Taliban...
Yeah, reputation of power is power.
Yeah, so the Taliban continuously throughout 2018 onwards, or even before that, they had the sense that the United States is weak, or they want to negotiate, they want to withdraw. So why to negotiate meaningfully? So just wait.
Indeed. And a number of things that the United States did during the implementation phase aggravated that impression. And one that's close to the heart of Australians related to the prisoner release issue. The Doha agreement provided that the absent Afghan government would release up to 5,000 combat and political prisoners.
Yeah, this was completely violation of sovereignty of Afghanistan because they had the authority to release them.
The Munich agreement, incidentally, also provided for prisoner releases. This was of interest to Australia because there was a rogue sergeant of the Afghan military, Hekmatullah, who had killed three Australian soldiers within their barracks, that is, not in a combat situation, but when he was wearing a uniform of the Afghan army. And he was captured and was in the custody of the Afghan government. Until September 2020, the United States was on the same page as Australia in agreeing that Hekmatullah was not a combat or political prisoner. He was a war criminal, clearly a war criminal under the Geneva Conventions,
yeah.
And therefore should not be released. The Taliban made his release a precondition for the commencement of intra-Afghan negotiations, which, as you'll remember, were stalled and stalled and stalled far beyond the 10th of March date on which they were supposed to have begun. And the United States then did a 180-degree switch supported the release of Hekmatullah, twisting the arm of the Afghan government relentlessly in order to procure this outcome. And the Australian government contacted the United States at the highest level to object to this because of the grief that it would cause to the surviving families of the three soldiers who'd been murdered, amongst other things, and got nowhere at all. And that's the classic example of something that then sends a signal to a group like the Taliban that if you ask for something, no matter how outrageous, and you're dealing with somebody who simply wants to cut and run, you're likely to get what you want.
Yeah.
And my late friend Owen Harries, the founding editor of the journal The National Interest, used to say, if you act as if you can be taken for granted, you will be taken for granted. Mm.
But this also referred somehow to another flaw in the process where at the beginning it was the envoy of United States borrowed a principle from Northern Ireland's peace process and Colombia's, where he said that nothing is agreed until everything is agreed. This was an established principle in the previous peace processes. But what he did, he, for example, agreed for the release of prisoners. He agreed for withdrawal without Taliban making a commitment to start talks or ceasefires with the government of Afghanistan. So ideally, things should have been sorted sequentially, right? One thing went after the other. But yeah. Taliban didn't follow the same path.
That was the clearest manifestation one could wish to find of the amateurism of the diplomatic approach that the United States took. And here I'm wearing my hat as a professor of diplomacy. The nothing is agreed until everything is agreed formula is a perfectly reputable one, because what it ensures is that a foreshadowed concession will become concrete if and only if it is matched by a reciprocal concession of equal value.
Right. But Taliban didn't reciprocate.
No, that's right. And but the reason they didn't have to reciprocate was, as you say, the United States abandoned that principle of negotiation in favor of a two-state process. And the danger of a two-stage process, is that if the other side feels that it has received everything it really wants or cares about at the first stage of the process, it has no incentive whatsoever to engage seriously in a subsequent stage of the process. This is something that any textbook on negotiation will tell you. In fact, if you go back to Francis Bacon's essay on negotiating, written in 1597, he says it is better to deal with people who are in appetite than people who are where they want to be. It's the most elementary principle of negotiating. And of course, what the Doha Agreement did was give to the Taliban everything they really wanted.
Yeah.
It gave them a place at the table with the United States and the status that flowed from that. It gave them a firm timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. and allied forces, to which the United States basically stuck.
Right.
And it gave them 5,000 combat or political prisoners.
Right.
In, as you say, in violation of the sovereignty of the Afghan government at the time.
Yeah.
So under the circumstances, the only incentive that the Taliban had was to engage in strategic stalling thereafter. To me, it's actually evidence of the danger of using people like Zalmay Khalilzad in these kind of complex negotiations, because career diplomats tend to be alert to these kind of dangers, but he was not a career diplomat. He was a freewheeling kind of customer who I think was probably hyperactive, didn't spend enough time regrouping and thinking through how to proceed thereafter. And you will remember very clearly when we were together in Kabul in September 2019, after the President Trump had suspended the process because of the deaths of an American service personnel who was killed in a Taliban attack. Someone in our audience at the American university asked what I thought should be done with the peace process, and I quoted Churchill's comment on the death of a political opponent, which was embalm, cremate, bury, take no chances. And it would have been very wise for the United States at that time not to rush back into a negotiation process, but instead to sit back, to regroup, to think about where the process was actually going. We now know that within a matter of days of that discussion that we had in Kabul, the Americans were desperately trying to reopen discussions with the Taliban, which again sent the signal that they were keen to cut and run, which again was the worst possible kind of signal to send. One really can't underestimate the amateurism associated with any diplomat who goes into a negotiating process signaling to the other side that he or she is desperate for an agreement.
Yeah, but do you think it's exclusively because of personality or character or lack of skills that Khalilzad had? Because you also, I think, mentioned in your article that he was somehow like a carte blanche where he had full authority. But we understand that he was a bureaucrat or a diplomat of state, and it was a complex bureaucracy, and nothing is just on the authority of Khalilzad, but it was a State Department or the United States policy as such. So the entire administration should have been critiqued rather than person of Khalilzad.
Yeah. Where I think one needs to differentiate between different players there is that Trump, as president, was famously inattentive to detail. His attention span was extremely limited. It was once described to me by somebody who'd briefed him as maximum 2 minutes on any issue.
Mm.
Pompeo, I think, was probably following the issue more carefully, but he was notorious for doing whatever Trump wanted.
Mm.
And I think one can develop a plausible argument that with Trump having pulled out of the process in early September, it would not have been beyond the wit of his advisers to give him a string of good reasons why he should tread very carefully thereafter.
Hmm.
Notably the possibility that there could be a spectacular collapse in Afghanistan in the run-up to the scheduled 2020 presidential election that could be very damaging to his election prospects. That's the kind of argument that would have counted to him. As far as I know, there's no evidence that there was any attempt by people in the State Department leadership to persuade Trump to that effect. I haven't seen any evidence that it was Trump who initiated the re-engagement with the Taliban either. This may come out at some point in the future. It's one of the things that's unclear. It is very clear, however, that Khalilzad was champing at the bit to get involved again.
But what about Ghani's administration on the other hand? It seems that you do not address that in your article. For example, Ghani didn't understand the importance of having a mediator in the process. He also continuously tried to undermine political cohesion and consensus, political consensus on his side in the Republic. And he tried to buy time, delay the process. And that was what Americans also understand, that Ghani is trying to continuously delay the process, as Taliban was trying to do, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, I think there are several different elements that come into play there. One was, I think, that the divide and rule approach to politics was one that President Ghani pursued that was not just related to diplomatic activities on the part of the United States. It was a wider theme of his presidency, really, that that he was not a pluralistic political leader. And I think he understood the Taliban very clearly because he was not a power sharer either. And that partly animated his approach to the situation. But to be fair to him, with a presidential election coming up in November 2020, it made some sense to stall to some degree in the hope that a new US administration would be able to offer better terms to the Afghan government than had arisen from the Doha Agreement. And indeed, that was not an irrational assumption if one looks at the recommendations that were put forward by the Afghanistan Study Group, a bipartisan group that was established under the auspices of the United States Institute for Peace. In a sense, even if that was all that President Ghani had been waiting to see, the pursuit of those recommendations would have created a somewhat different situation on the ground to that which he ended up confronting. It was not certain that Biden would go down the path that he did.
Yeah.
It was possible. But I'm not one who falls in altogether with the line that the Afghan government mishandled it because the Americans were always going to withdraw completely in terms with the provisions of the Doha Agreement. One simply couldn't say that with certainty with a presidential election coming up. Things turned out Biden did stick to the terms that had been negotiated by Khalilzad and signed by Pompeo. Signed by Khalilzad under Pompeo's auspices. But
we
that
earlier
wasn't certain.
Spoke about the character of Trump and how he was making decisions and hence the way that Khalilzad used this opportunity. But also you mentioned about the recommendations of the Afghanistan Study Group by USIP. One of the key recommendations over there was to make the withdrawal of troops conditioned to the a successful outcome of intra-Afghanistan dialogue. But why Biden administration didn't buy such kind of recommendation?
I think there are several possibilities here, and you have to be given that the decision was made by one man, to some degree you have to get inside his head in order to work out what was going on. I think there were several different things at play. One was that Biden, I think, had always smarted at the fact that when he had opposed the surge that President Obama announced in 2009, the military had prevailed over him in the argument within policy circles in the United States. And I think he may have seen 2021 as giving him an opposition, an opportunity to show who was the president. I think that was part of it. I think it was also the case that Biden had been regarded with considerable suspicion by the progressive wing of the Democrat Party because of his very strong support for the invasion of Iraq in 2003. And so cutting and running from Afghanistan was a way of ingratiating himself with that particular wing of the party, not for electoral purposes, but for the purposes of locking in votes within the Congress, where that progressive wing is represented to some degree. And then I suspect that there was also a degree to which he had sort of soaked up the rhetoric that the war in Afghanistan was endless and unwinnable, and that under those circumstances one should cut and run. That's philosophically interesting because it shows the dominance of a particular conception of victory, which you might relate to, you know, Appomattox in 1865 or Tokyo Bay in 1945, where one side surrenders to another, and that's the way in which you have victory in a war. Yeah. That was never going to happen with the Taliban. But if you go in with a model of victory that is premised on that kind of understanding, and there's some evidence that that is the dominant way of thinking about victory that prevails in American policy circles, then it was always going to be a losing hand. Now, that's not to say that the best outcome was one where you would cut and run. A better outcome might be one where you rethink what victory might actually mean or what success might mean, or whether not losing might be a desirable outcome in and of itself. Because, frankly, if you look at the situation in Europe, between the fall of France in June 1940 and the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, if one had actually said to Prime Minister Churchill in London, what is your strategy for defeating Nazi Germany on your own? He would not have been able to come up with a credible strategy. Which indeed was one reason why the Foreign Secretary, Viscount Halifax, in late May in 1940, when the fall of France was imminent, was in favour of going into a negotiating process if it seemed to be on offer with Nazi Germany. What Churchill envisaged and understood was that the situation's parameters could change, which began to happen when Germany invaded the Soviet Union in June 1941 and then dramatically occurred when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and Germany then declared war on the United States. And Churchill had the wisdom to see that not losing can be a perfectly feasible strategy. And in a way, I think that's the chickens have come home to roost in the context of Afghanistan now, because if you look at the current situation in Ukraine and ask why, not just why did Russia invade Ukraine, but why did Russia invade Ukraine now, at this moment, rather than in 2008, when NATO membership for Ukraine first surfaced. I was actually in the room in Bucharest when President George W. Bush announced that the United States would support NATO membership action plans for Georgia and Ukraine. There's a mounting body of opinion embracing people ranging from Sir Lawrence Friedman to Elliot Cohen to the former Russian Foreign Minister Andrei Kozyrev, which links the invasion of Ukraine to the perception of weakness on the part of the United States that flowed from its
symbolic given the fact that Afghanistan was an ally of, by treaty, it was a
major non-NATO ally under US law. Under those circumstances, if you start factoring in the costs, not just direct costs, but the costs in the global economy, in terms of food supply to countries in the third world and that kind of thing, into the abandonment of Afghanistan, the cost-benefit calculation begins to look very different. And in fact, if you go back and have a look at American expenditure on Afghanistan in 2020, it's rather interesting. The direct US funding to the Afghan government in 2020 amounted to 0.0007% of federal outlays. The entire cost of US involvement in Afghanistan, the cost of the US military presence and military activity and that kind of thing, amounted to 0.007% of federal outlays in the United States. What's so often forgotten is that the Afghanistan had long since ceased to be a costly war for the United States from 2014 onwards. And indeed, it had ceased even in human terms to be a costly conflict. The total number of US soldiers killed in Afghanistan between the end of 2014 and the collapse on the 15th of August 2021 was 64. And on average, every day in the United States, 59 people die in non-suicide gun violence.
So a strong, plausible argument could be that the US did not consider the consequences of this policy and action.
The calculations that the United States made seem not to have taken into sufficient account the consequences of withdrawal. Because when you're making calculations about costs and benefits, you can base your calculations on the prospects that you will achieve a positive outcome of a kind for which you might have hoped in the past. But it's also important to take into account the possible negative consequences in the future that might flow from decisions that you're making in the here and now, because they can actually be very substantial and costly as well. And that could apply in a number of different respects, because quite apart from, say, the situation in Ukraine, one could also look at the evidence that's been mustered and presented to the UN Security Council about the ongoing links between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which is the subject of a discussion of an article in the latest issue of the Journal of Survival, just produced by the International Institute for Strategic Studies. And I know that serious scholars who are looking at terrorism are genuinely apprehensive that Al-Qaeda might be in a position to reconstitute itself to the point where it could mount a significant attack in a Western country in the future. So there we're reminded of Hegel's famous comment that the Owl of Minerva spreads her wings when dusk is settling, that it's probably too early to tot up all the possible negative consequences of the withdrawal from Afghanistan. There are plenty already which seem to outweigh what the positive consequences might have been if one aim was, as Stephen Walt, for example, argued, to free up the United States to be a more credible and active player in the containment of China. Well, it's very doubtful whether the spectacle of the United States fleeing Afghanistan had that effect at all. Here it's worth drawing a contrast, which is not often drawn, between the U.S. evacuation of Saigon in April 1975 at the end of the Vietnam War and the exit from Afghanistan. And the critical point here is that the international environment was very different at the two times. In 1975, China was still, despite some incendiary rhetoric, very much an inward-looking state because of the disruptions that the Cultural Revolution under Mao Zedong had produced from 1965 onwards. And in terms of the relationship with the Soviet Union, 1975 was actually the high point of the policy of détente promoted by Dr. Kissinger, which in a sense culminated in the signing in the second half of 1975 of the Helsinki Accords, the final act of the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe. And so in a sense, the inward-looking character of China and the prevalence of détente in the wider Soviet-American relationship meant that the costs to the United States of the exit from Vietnam were not that great. The bulk of US forces were actually gone from Vietnam and had been for some years. In Afghanistan, it was a different story. The Afghanistan debacle occurred in circumstances where both Russia and China were revanchist in their aims. Russia in respect of Ukraine, as we'd seen with the 2014 occupation of territory in eastern Ukraine, and China in respect of the South China Sea. It was 2021 was not a time for the weakening of general deterrence. If you take, for example, Patrick Morgan's distinction between specific deterrence designed to deter an immediate action and general deterrence, namely a reputational standing which would make a hostile power wary about taking the risk of doing
it. It seems that to the end of this podcast that we had multiple failed peace processes and agreements in Afghanistan, and one is, of course, Geneva Agreement on Afghanistan 1988 and later on April 92, but multiple other negotiations throughout the last 30 years that between Taliban and the opponents, whoever had been the Republic or the previous governments. We have not learned the lessons in our engagement or in our disengagement with the Taliban. Be it the true formal peace processes or otherwise. What would be two, three lessons that you may suggest to the future sort of peace processes in Afghanistan that we should take into consideration?
Yes, there are several, and it's a very good point. First, I think, is that one needs to recognize that very few peace processes or negotiation processes in the past in Afghanistan worked out the way in which the architects planned. And that is certainly something which US players should have had in mind when they were negotiating with the Taliban, that there were potential unintended consequences or ways in which an agreement could miscarry that needed to be carefully contemplated, taken into account. So that would be a first point, I think, that things don't necessarily work out the way in which you plan. The second is that you need to understand very clearly the character of the actor with which you're engaging. And here, Dr. Fahunda Akbari has done some very good work on the challenges of negotiating with armed non-state actors, comparing the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia and the negotiation with them that led to the Paris Agreement, and negotiations with the Taliban. And it takes far more than just a smiling face on the part of a delegate in Doha to establish that it is safe to negotiate with a particular group. And here I'd make the point that Western players tended grossly to overestimate their knowledge of the internal political dynamics of the Taliban. There were some things we did know about the Taliban, that they historically were not power sharers. That was very obvious, and that they were highly ideological. But the fact that they had been successful in hiding for 2 years the death of their founding leader should have told us something about how limited was our knowledge of the internal political dynamics, which would end up being critical in shaping whether any agreement would be implemented in good faith or not. Certainly, it was exceedingly dangerous to treat the delegate in and delegation in Doha as simply as if they bound all the different participants within what Thomas Ortig had accurately described as a network of networks. That was a very, very dangerous kind of assumption. Yet, of course, it was critical to the negotiation. At the moment one conceded that the people in the room were not necessarily speaking authoritatively or in a binding fashion for other elements of the movement, the danger of the whole process would have become obvious. And that would lead me to the last points I'd make. One is people tend to assume that it's automatically a good thing to negotiate. And people go back to Churchill's famous comment, better George or than war. But it's worth bearing in mind that he said that in the 1950s in the context of negotiations with the Soviet Union to prevent a nuclear war. He did not say it in the 1930s in the context of the rise of Nazi Germany. And there are certain circumstances in which it can be very dangerous to negotiate, because you can lock yourself into patterns of behaviour from which it's very difficult then to extract yourself, which are extraordinarily risky. And Kate Clark of the Afghanistan's Analyst Network pointed this out very clearly when she talked about the fantasy castles that were built around the peace process, where you were having seminars and papers being written on how the Afghan constitution would be drafted to take account of the gender policies of the Taliban. And I remember looking at this and thinking, this is just dreamy stuff. And that leads to a final broader point. And it was the point that Telford Taylor made about the Munich Agreement, that there are dangers in not facing up to unpleasant realities. And I think the two critical unpleasant realities that people were not prepared in the negotiation process to confront was that the sanctuary issue in Pakistan was central rather than peripheral. And as long as that went unaddressed, negotiations were likely to end up having catastrophic consequences. And the other was the assumption that one knew sufficient about the Taliban that you could be confident that they weren't simply using the negotiation process as a kind of Trojan horse in order to cover up a military campaign to take over the entire country.
With that, I think we come to the end of this episode. Bill, thank you so much for your time. I would like to also extend my gratitude to our listeners. Thank you so much for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this conversation, please don't forget to subscribe to this podcast and make sure to share it with your friends on social media. Looking forward to speaking with you on the next episode.